Welcome to Torti Mecha Nachyomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rachel Besser, and today we will be studying Ezra Perek Dalet, Chapter 4. Last Perek, we saw the height of excitement of bringing Korbanot again at the Mikdash site and the celebration of the groundbreaking ceremony of the Beit HaMikdash. The Perek, however, ended with an exposure of the internal divisions of the Second Temple community based on their different expectations that each of the different generations had of what the Beit HaMikdash and their lives in Israel would look like. Perek Dalet brings further challenges, not internally, but from the outside. The Perek begins by introducing us to a new group of people who are going to be referred to as the Tzarei Yehudah, the enemies of Judah. Obviously, this is not the name that they call themselves. It's a name given to them by Ezra, the narrator, and is going to be based on what happens in the end of this story. From Zerubbabel's perspective, when he meets them, they're a neutral group of people. And they are introduced to us in Pasuk Aleph. Vayishmu'u tzarei Yehuda bin Yamin, ki b'nei hagola bonim heichal Hashem Elokei Yisrael. The enemies of Yehuda and Binyamin hear that the people of the exile have come back to Israel and are now building a temple to Hashem, the God of the Jews. And they have an interesting request, this group of people, which they express in verse 2. They come to Zerubbabel, they approach him, Vel Roshei Ha'avod, and to the heads of the households, Vayomru Lahem, they say, Nivne Imachem, we would like to build the Beit HaMikdash with you, Ki Kachem Nidrosh Leilokechem, and because just like you, we serve your God, Velo Anachnu Zavchim, Mimea Sar Chadon, Melech Ashur, Hama'ale Otanu Po, and we have been serving him for many years from the time of Asar Chadon, the king of Assyria, who brought us here. Besides knowing what they want, which is to build the temple, we also have a little bit more info about these people. We know that they claim to worship Hashem just like the Jews, and that they were brought to Israel by the Assyrians in the time of King Asarhaddon, the son of Sancheirib, who ruled Assyria from 680 to 669 BC, so almost 150 years before our current story. These two pieces of information push the Mefarshim to identify this group of people as the Shomronim, people who live in the Shomron, the northern part of Israel, the land where the 10 tribes used to live. And this is a varied group of non-Jews from different parts of the Assyrian Empire who were brought to the north of Israel after the exile of the 10 tribes as part of the Assyrian policy of mixing up conquered people's locations. In terms of the service of Hashem, Rashi points us to Malachim Bet chapter 17, which you may remember from Nachyomi a long time ago, in which this group of people comes to the north of Israel, starts to worship idolatry like they're used to, and then lions come out and begin to attack them. They in turn send a message to the king of Assyria, Sarhaddon, and say, what's this crazy land that you brought us to? We don't know how to worship the god of this land. He sends them, such a fascinating story, he sends them a Jewish priest who teaches them about Hashem, and they actually start to worship Hashem. They don't give up their idolatry, but they worship Hashem and their idolatry concurrently, which is apparently enough to stop the lions. And that's their background, these Shomronim. So now we understand why they say that they worship Hashem, based on that story from Malachim Bet. And now these people have a request of Zerubbabel and Yehoshua. We would like to join you in building the Beit HaMikdash. Now, the Shomronim's arrival seems to be the answer to a prayer. What plagued the community beforehand was twofold. Number one, they were worried about the surrounding nations. And number two, they didn't have enough money to make this Beit HaMikdash look like the first one. Now, of course, it wouldn't solve the problem of not having an Aron, but it would be better than nothing. Additionally, the community is already diverse, and there are 9 non-Jews in this community, and it seems to be that this community does have the wherewithal to include different types of people and people with different identities within the community. However, there is a danger. First of all, are they trustworthy? Maybe they don't actually want to serve Hashem and the Beit HaMikdash, but maybe they just want to worm their way into the communities in order to undermine it from within. They were around during the first temple period. Why didn't they try to join then? Secondly, religiously, they believe that they worship Hashem just like the Jews, but clearly they don't. The story in Malachim 17 notes that they continue to do idolatry. Would allowing them to join introduce idolatry into this community that doesn't seem to have that problem as of now? And how would they feel about their ownership of the Beit HaMikdash? Would they be content to just help build, but then not have a say in the religious direction that the new Beit HaMikdash goes in? And does the community have the wherewithal to be even more diverse? Unlike the Netinim and the Bnei Avdei Shlomo, who recognize that they are non-Jews who live within a Jewish community, do these people consider themselves Jewish or not? Or are they like the people from Tel Harasha who just don't know? But unlike the people of Tel Harasha, are they willing to submit to the idea that they don't know, in terms of also Bnei Barzilai saying, well, you know, you don't know if you're Kohanim or not, and therefore you cannot work in the Beit HaMikdash, even though it's very possible that you might be a Kohen. Will their introduction strain the community so much that it breaks? And that is the challenge to Zerubbabel and Yehoshua, and it is immense. Can they afford to include them? But can they afford not to include them? What would happen if they would say no? They make the wrong decision, they could potentially take a friendly group of neighbors and make them into enemies. And if they say yes and they are wrong, they can end up losing the very Beit HaMikdash and Jewish community that they come to build. Zerubbabel and Yehoshua's answer is strong and unequivocal. Vayomer lehem Zerubbabel, Yehoshua, Ushar, Roshei Ha'avot Israel, everyone together, Zerubbabel, Yehoshua, and all the heads of the household say, Lo lachem v'lanu livnot bayit lelokenu. It is not for you and us to build the Beit HaMikdash. Ki anachnu yachad nivnet l'Hashem. We together will build a house for Hashem, Elokei Yisrael, our God, Kasher Tzivanu, Hamelech Koresh, Melech Paras, just like Cyrus commanded us. Note the use of the word yachad. Us together. There are two types of unity. Unity with outsiders and unity with insiders. According to Zerubbabel and Yehoshua, the Beit HaMikdash is a place of unity, but only for those within the community. Perhaps Zerubbabel believes that Yishael's universal vision for the Beit HaMikdash that he expresses in the second parak of Yishael, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim, that the word of the Torah should come out from Zion, from Yerushalayim, and affect all non-Jews as well who will come to the Beit HaMikdash and express themselves to Hashem in the Beit HaMikdash, cannot be fulfilled by having non-Jews who are likely idol worshippers join in the building process itself. Only when we are strong within ourselves can we spread the message outwards and bring people in. Unsurprisingly, the Shomronim do not take to this dismissal very well. Whether it's because they were actually trying to undermine the Jews from the beginning and never really wanted to participate in the building, or whether they were truly insulted at being rebuffed, they turn nasty. Vayhi am ha'aretz merapim yedei am Yehuda, umivhalim otam livnot. This nation goes and they weaken the hands of the people of Yehuda and they stop them from building. How do they do this? So rimaleim yoatzim, they hire lobbyists, advisors, lafer atzatam, kol yemei Koresh, melech paras, v'ad melech mitar yavesh melech paras, the entire rest of the reign of Koresh and all the way until the time of King Darius, they hire people that are going to go and spread lies about the Jews. Now, it's not clear from this pasuk whether Cyrus actually withdraws support or if faced with this intense pressure, the Jews don't even try to continue, but it is clear that the Beit HaMikdash process comes to an abrupt stop and is not picked up until 18 years later in the time of King Darius the Great, as we'll see later in the story. At this point, the parak swerves and tells us about other instances at this time period in which the Jews faced enemies who tried to hurt them. Pasuk 6 recounts the most famous of them. Uba malchut Achashverosh, b'tchilat malchuto, katvu sitna al yoshvei Yehudi v'Yishalayim. In the time period of Achashverosh, in the beginning of his reign, they wrote a decree against the people of Yehudi and Yishalayim. This pasuk is the only mention of the Purim story outside of Megillat Esther and helps us place the story not as a tale on its own, but as an ongoing campaign of different people during the Persian Empire who lobbied the Persian kings against what they saw as a threatening people. While we have had many instances of countries fighting against the Jews of Judea and Samaria in Sefer Malachim, this is the first parak that feels like modern-day anti-Semitism. Following this one pasuk, Psukim 7-24, are written in Aramaic and detail a letter sent by a group of non-Jews to the Persian king Artaxasta, telling him about the work that the Jews are doing in building up Jerusalem and building its walls. These people warn that if this type of work continues, the Jews will declare their independence and stop paying taxes. In order to back up their claims, they encourage Artaxasta to look through the record books and see that Jerusalem has actually a very long history of being a rebellious city and declaring their independence from their ruling powers. This claim is clearly true, as we know from Malachim and Yirmiyahu, that the last three kings of Yehuda, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachim, and Zedekiah, all rebelled against Babylonia before the Korban. Even Yoshiyahu pushed away King Parnacho of Egypt as he was trying to walk through his land. So Artaxerxes does his research and responds that he has looked into the matter and found it to be true. Jerusalem does have a history of being a rebellious city. He therefore tells the group of accusers that they must go to Jerusalem and stop the builders at once, which they happily do. The last pasuk, pasuk 24, says that the time of the work of the Beit HaMikdash, at that time, the work of the Beit HaMikdash was stopped until the time of King Darius, which is 18 years after the building was first started. Before we talk about the contents of this letter, it is interesting to note some of the history surrounding such a letter. It is unusual to have the text of the letter written in Aramaic included in a book of Tanakh. The letter is uniquely Persian and consistent with a number of innovations of the Persian Empire. One innovation was the postal system, which allowed for many more letters to go back and forth between Judea and Persia. Another innovation, which we may not love, is the development of the taxation system. The people in the letter specifically state that the Jews will stop paying taxes if they continue building. It was only during the Persian Empire that the provinces began to pay regular taxes to the foreign government. The Persian Empire also saw the development of a major innovation, paper. It's possible that the letters were more ubiquitous than before because they were easier to write and deliver than the stone tablets that had been used in the past. Lastly, the Persians were expert record keepers, and it would be fitting, therefore, to ask the monarch to check the records and look into the history of the city of Jerusalem. The letter fits with the theme of Parak 4, in which the fledgling Jewish community confronts people who are suspicious of them, who are worried that they are getting too powerful, which is ironic because they're not powerful at all. In the first section, it is the Shomronim, who are possibly insulted at not being included in the Jewish community's building, or possibly were looking for a way to undermine the Beit HaMikdash project because they didn't want a strong Jewish presence living right next door to them. This is followed by the government of Achashverosh, who wrote a decree against the Jews, and then finally, the letter to Artaxerxes, in which a very concerned group of people who live on the other side of the Jordan River claim in verses 12 to 13, and I'm quoting in English because the letter is written only in Aramaic, "Be it known to the king that the Jews who came up from you to us have reached Jerusalem and are rebuilding that rebellious and wicked city. They are completing the walls and repairing the foundation. Now be it known to the king, if this city is rebuilt and the walls completed, they will not pay tribute, poll tax, or land tax, and in the end it will harm the kingdom." This is a very strong argument that Artaxerxes does not take lightly. He searches the records, finds that Jerusalem indeed had rebelled against Babylonia a number of times when they were a vassal state. Worried, Artaxerxes comes down hard on the Jews and forces them to stop building the walls. The honeymoon between the Jews and the Persian Empire, tenuous at best, has ended. Over and over, the Persian kings prove themselves not to be trustworthy and able to be swayed by groups who hate the Jews. The last pasuk brings us back to the time of Cyrus and Zerubbabel. Ba'adin bitlat avadat beit aloka di b'Yerushalayim v'avat bitala ad shnat tartin l'malchut daryavesh melech paras. At that time, the work on the house of God in Jerusalem was stopped and remained until the second year of the reign of King Darius of Persia. The advisors hired by the Tzarei Yehuda in Persia had their way and were a tremendous influence on Cyrus. Rashi reads the letter to Artaxerxes as actually a letter to Cyrus itself, the statement of the Tzarei Yehuda. He explains that Artaxerxes is actually a generic name for a Persian leader, almost like Pharaoh or Caesar, and the letter was how the Tzarei Yehuda convinced Cyrus. Others read the letter as happening at a different time period and just a third instance of anti-Semitism against the Jews. Either way, the challenges against the Jewish community are immense. Nothing is smooth. Internally, they are divided on how much money to spend on the Beit HaMikdash and what it should look like. Economically, they are challenged with the monumental task of rebuilding a destroyed country, building up the necessary infrastructure, starting an agricultural economy while also preparing to build the Beit HaMikdash. Politically, they are facing fickle leaders who support them one year but turn their back on them the next. The surrounding tribes want them to fail, and to top it off, as we learn in Sefer Chagai, a famine starts. It seems like it just can't get worse. The people and the leadership fall apart, and the Mizbeach built at the site of the earlier altar is left outside to face the elements with no Beit HaMikdash built around it. The temple project is abandoned. So to summarize, in this parak, we see an immense challenge to the Jewish people, not from the inside, as we saw at the last parak, but from the outside. The Tzarei Yehuda come, first ask if they can build the Beit HaMikdash, but when they're told no, they go off and convince King Cyrus to withdraw his support from the Jewish people. Other instances of anti-Semitism are also recounted in this parak, both at the time of Achashverosh and at the time of Artaxerxes, the building project is stopped. And now this seems to be just the lowest point of the people who sacrificed so much to go to Israel and now have nothing. We'll see in the coming prakim how they're going to be able to solve these tremendous challenges. Thank you for studying together, Le'iloi Nishmat, Malka Esther, Bat Zvi Yosef.